From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Fox News anchor Tucker Carlson had a now famous exchange with a prominent European historian named Rutger Bregman that only became public after a video of the encounter was leaked. Bregman is the author of Utopia for Realists, The Case of a Universal Basic Income, Open Borders, and a 15-Hour Workweek. After he addressed wealthy elites in Davos, Switzerland, Carlson invited Bregman for an interview, but then lost his temper in an expletive-filled rant. A video of the tape recording that never aired has now gone viral. Here is an excerpt of the exchange.
America is still pretty much the most powerful country in the world, right? So if it really would want to, it could easily crack down on tax paradises. But the thing is, I mean, you guys have brought into power a president that doesn't even want to show its own tax returns. I mean, who knows how many billions he has hidden in the Cayman Islands or in Bermuda. So I think the issue really is one of corruption and of people being bribed and of not being, you know, not talking about the real issues. What the family, you know, what the Murdochs basically want you to do is to scapegoat immigrants instead of talking about tax avoidance. So I'm glad you're now finally raising the issue, but that's what been happening for the past couple of years.
Uh-huh. And I'm taking orders from the Murdochs, is that what you're saying?
No, I mean, it doesn't work that directly. But, I mean, you've been part of the Cato Institute, right? You've been a senior fellow there for years. You've been taking their dirty money. They're funded by Koch billionaires, you know?
Wait, why don't you tell me how it does work?
Well, it works by you taking their dirty money. It's as easy as that. I mean, you are a millionaire funded by billionaires. That's what you are. And I'm glad you now finally jumped the bandwagon, you know, of people like Bernie Sanders and AOC. But you're not part of the solution, Mr. Carlson. You're part of the problem, actually.
It's true, right?
That all the anchors. All the anchors on Fox, they're all millionaires. How is this possible? Well, it's very easy. You're just not talking about certain things.
Fox doesn't even play where you are.
It doesn't play where you are. Well, have you heard of the internet? I can watch things whatever I want, you know? I have, actually. I can't say I'm a great fan of your show, but I do my homework when you invite me on your show. So, I mean, you're probably not going to air this.
But I am talking about this issue.
Yeah, only now. Come on, you jumped the bandwagon. You're all like, oh, I'm against the globalist elite, blah, blah, blah. It's not very convincing, to be honest.
Why don't you go f*** yourself, you tiny brain, and I hope this gets picked up, because you're a moron. I tried to give you a hearing, but you were too annoying for me.
You can't handle the criticism, can you?
That's a now viral exchange between Fox News' Tucker Carlson and historian Rutger Bregman during an interview that never aired. Bregman was a guest on our show when his book was published in 2016, and today we'll re-air our conversation with him.
Imagine a life where you didn't need to work more than 15 hours a week to make ends meet. One where you weren't restricted by the place of your birth and the stamp on your passport, and where financial worries were not the main driver of your major life decisions. Sounds like utopia, right? But what if such a world were actually far more within our reach than we thought? Well, it turns out that long-term trends show that humans as a whole are actually moving in this very direction, and that there is already plenty of research proving that the time has come to realize such a utopia, at least according to my guest, Rutger Bregman. He is the best-selling author of the book Utopia for Realists, The Case of a Universal Basic Income, Open Borders, and a 15-Hour Workweek. He's considered one of Europe's most prominent young thinkers. Welcome to the program, Rutger.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, I think you're right that the time to consider this idea has come about. There's several folks, including yourself, these days who are talking about this idea of a basic universal income. However, you know, we constantly hear such terrible statistics about poverty and starvation the world over, poor rates of literacy, mortality, poor health, etc. Does that obscure how much progress humans have actually made over the last two centuries?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. You know, many people base their worldview on what they see and hear on the news. But the news is always about exceptions, you know, things that go wrong, about corruption, about terrorism, about all sorts of crises. And I'm not saying all these things aren't real. I'm just saying that you don't often hear about the things that don't happen or just the small steps in progress that we make every single day. So there's never a headline that says, today, breaking news, 10 billion or 6 billion people went to work and back again today. Or breaking news, child mortality declined by 0.000000% today. You know, those kind of things are invisible, but they're very important in the long run.
So what, I mean, and we should also realize here in the US, a 40-hour work week is considered sort of normal. Anything above that, you could get overtime. A lot of people do end up working more than that. Mm-hmm. However, there was a time, of course, when the 40-hour work week was considered utopia, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, for a very long time, from about 1850 till about 1980, the work week in all the Western world declined, kept getting shorter and shorter and shorter. So there were people back in the 1930s, for example, John Maynard Keynes, the very famous economist, who predicted that by 2030, we would have a work week of about 15 hours a week. Now, this sounds like a pretty crazy prediction to us nowadays. But actually, you know, up until the 60s and the 70s, almost all the economists and sociologists, all the trend watchers, everyone believed that this was going to happen at some point anyway, simply because we were getting richer.
A 15-hour work week, basically, that's people working about 3 hours a day. The standard response to that, and this is one prong of the three prongs of utopia that you discussed in your book, the standard response to a 15-hour work week would be, that's ridiculous. You'll end up with a society of lazy people, and we just can't mm-hmm. afford it. So what's your response to that?
Well, I think that you shouldn't get me wrong. I think that we should work less, do less paid work in order to do more. So what we see nowadays is that many people are stuck in a job that they even themselves consider kind of pointless or useless. There was a poll in the UK and they asked people, do you think your job adds anything of value to the world? And 37% of all the people who were asked this question said no. So there is a huge amount of waste in our current system of work. That's why I think we should do less paid labor in order to have more time to care work.
Right.
And kinds of things that
you point out in your book that we are working harder than ever in paid work to create products that we don't really need, and in many cases some of us can't even afford, but then we work hard so that we can afford them. And so our consumer-based economy is set up to actually be a very wasteful economy, even though neoliberal economic supporters of this system argue that it's the most innovative way. It's, you know, it encourages innovation, encourages competition, and is the most efficient way to set up our economy. How wasteful is our economic system right now?
Well, pretty wasteful, definitely. I mean, we're continuously buying stuff we don't need to impress people we don't like, and we do that with money we don't even have. So what I would think is that we have to go back to all of these old ideas of economists like John Maynard Keynes and John Stuart Mill, who said that we should trade a little bit of our prosperity for more leisure time. And as I said, you know, we've been doing this for 1.5 centuries, right until the 1980s. And it's only a very short while, just 30 years ago, that we started working more again. But I think that we should use all the, for example, the automation. Many people are talking about this right now, that the robots that they're coming for our jobs. And I think this is actually a good thing. You know, we should use that to work less and do more what we really care about. Yeah, jobs are for robots and life is for people.
So let's talk about the other aspect of your big ideas book that would really be a, you know, wonderful thing if people were to be able to make it a reality, and that is for universal basic income. I mean, I'm one of those people who are lucky enough to have a very meaningful job. I wouldn't trade it for the world, but boy, do I wish I was getting paid enough to make ends meet, right? Often meaningful work in our society, like journalism, like those who are teachers, et cetera, just don't get paid enough, and so we're constantly struggling. Mm-hmm. How real is this idea, and what is it really based on? A universal basic income that the government simply distributes a modest amount of cash in people's pockets?
Well, I think that what would happen if you would give a basic income to everyone is that many people on the bottom of society, like the garbage men, the teachers, and the care workers, you know, they would have a lot of more bargaining power. They could always say, you know, I can fall back on my basic income and stop doing my paid work. And that means that the basic income will sort of work like a universal strike fund. It will mean that the wages of these people who do the really useful, meaningful work will get higher and higher. And what we see nowadays, you know, in our capitalistic system of the moment, is that sometimes it seems completely upside down. So the people who have all these jobs that they even themselves consider meaningless, sometimes like bankers or corporate lawyers or PR consultants, you know, these are the people that often say, when researchers ask them, do you find your job useful? They often say, well, actually not. And the weird thing is that they earn the most money. Now, I think that basic income would be an instrument to turn that around.
Now, the idea that you would give people money, especially poor people money, is something that goes against even what a lot of liberal politicians recommend. I mean, this week is a 20th anniversary of the welfare reform laws that Bill Clinton enacted, a liberal Democratic president who really kind of undermined this idea that you can trust poor people to make decisions about themselves. What is the research out there that shows, and you point out that, you know, poor people are not idiots. Has it been studied what happens when you just give people who are poor a bunch of money rather than services? I mean, our standard approach these days to dealing with poverty is let's educate them, let's give them help, but not actually put cash in their hands.
Well, I studied tens of experiments that have been happening all around the world. So from Canada to the US, the Netherlands, and in England, and also in a lot of developing countries in the global south. And time again, what researchers have found is that poverty is not so much a lack of character, but it's just a lack of money. So what we see in the data is
that poor people...
But
that's an obvious thing, right? Obviously, poverty is a lack of money.
Well, often we think that poverty is a lack of character. So what we see in the data is that many poor people make decisions that aren't very smart. So they get more loans that they can't repay. They eat less healthily, they don't raise their kids well enough. And often people, especially on the conservative side, says there's something like, you know, a character of being poor, there's something intrinsically wrong with poor people. This is what Margaret Thatcher actually said. She said that poverty is a character deficit. But what the research shows is that everyone would make unwise decisions if they would live in a context of poverty. There's really fascinating research that's been done, for example, by Elder Shafir from Princeton University. And what they did, for example, they went to India and they asked sugarcane farmers to do an intelligence test before and after the harvest. Now, the thing with sugarcane farmers in India is that they receive almost all of their income, of their yearly income, half of it, after the harvest. So before the harvest, they're poor, and after that, they're rich. And guess what? After the harvest, they have 13 more IQ points than before it. So this is huge. You know, it's the same effect as alcoholism or losing a night's sleep.
So financial security basically makes you
breakthrough in the research into poverty.
So financial security allows you to make or enables you psychologically to just make better decisions about your life because you're not in a constant stress.
Yes, and if you think about it, that's actually an astonishing finding, because it means that if you eradicate poverty, then your whole country will get smarter. If you eradicate poverty, then that will probably be, in the long run, an investment. You know, we have research, for example, from the US that shows that just child poverty already costs $500 billion each year. Now, what would it cost to eradicate poverty in the US? Only $175 billion. So this is an investment that will give you a huge return on investment. You know, every entrepreneur, every businessman would say, you know, I would do the investment. I would jump at it.
Tell us about the example that you write about of the Cherokee Indians in North Carolina and what happened when they built a casino, a tribe that went from, you know, being so poor that the children in the tribe had terrible indicators. What happened after they became wealthy?
Yeah, this was quite a coincidence. So what happened in the 90s is that a casino opened in North Carolina, and all the earnings, or a lot of the earnings, were distributed among the members of the tribe, the Indians tribe. And a coincidence would have it that just a few years before that, Jane Costello, a professor of Duke University, had started researching about 1,400 kids who lived in that neighborhood, so she could see what the psychological effect of raising kids out of poverty would be. And it was huge. They even found out that in the long run, this money paid for itself. So the reductions in healthcare costs and lower crime rates and, for example, better investments in education and higher tax incomes and all those kinds of things, they were actually higher than the initial cash transfer had even been. So yeah, this is some of the most fascinating research that we now know about.
You also cite an example in your book about what happened when I think it was homeless veterans that received a chunk of cash.
Yeah.
I mean, this is remarkable. Tell us about this. Essentially, a social experiment.
Yeah, it's one of the most bizarre stories, I guess, in my book. You know, what they did in 2010 in the city of London is they had about 13 homeless people had been living on the streets for sometimes almost 40 years. So these men were sometimes really regarded as hopeless. You know, everything had been tried by the care workers at that point. So it was time for something new. And at some point, someone thought, you know, why not try free money instead? You know, let's just see what happens. Let's give them £3,000 and see what happens. So that's what they did. And many of the care workers said, you know, this is probably not going to work. You know, many were very skeptical, but whatever, let's see what happens. And, you know, the astonishing result was that just a year after the experiment had started, 7 of the 30 men had a roof above their head, and 2 more had applied for housing. So even the economists, you know, magazine that's always in favor of the free market, etc., even they said that the most efficient way to spend money on the homeless might be just to give it to them. So if we've been doing it wrong for years and decades, you know, in development aid, in our welfare systems, we've been trying to work with education and teaching poor people, and all the time we thought that there's something wrong with poor people or homeless people. But the thing is, they just lack money. And it's quite easy to solve that problem.
And it's just such a straightforward solution that's not based on patronizing poor people. Because a lot of these ideas you know, instead of putting money in people's hands, we should teach them a skill, we should give them a loan, we should provide them schools. Well, you know, yes, all of those things are great, but then a chunk of cash in someone's hands, allowing for them to make the best decisions about their lives, simply not just gives them dignity, but also it turns out has the best outcome. And in the end, the government ends up spending much less money on that same person than they would have to provide government assistance. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, don't get me wrong, I don't think that education is useless.
Right, of course.
I mean, there are many courses, for example, in financial literacy. The poor really do learn something in all kinds of courses. But as Professor Shafir said to me, it's the same thing as teaching someone to swim and then throwing him into the ocean. You know, of course that person will drown. It's not that he didn't learn anything, but the context is just too overwhelming. So you first have to change that context. And then, you know, there's education will definitely be important.
Right.
But first, you have to get people out of poverty.
My guest is Rutger Bregman. He's the best-selling author of the book Utopia for Realists, The Case of a Universal Basic Income, Open Borders, and a 15-Hour Workweek. I'm going to keep Rutger on with us for an extended conversation, particularly tackling the open borders part of his book. And you can find that interview on the premium content section of our website. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.